me the situation that you got into with this car. I got to hear this.
I'm driving down Lincoln Drive, which, if you know Philadelphia, is a very serpentine road. And it's one of these situations, as you know from being a parent, we've got one kid on one side of the city who had a sleepover. We had a kid on the other side of the city, and he had a sleepover. We've got to pick up both kids and get them to their events that are happening the next day, right? So
right.
We're going in two different directions. I'm coming down this road, and I hit a pothole, and I'm telling you, this thing had to have been 2 feet deep. And I hit it square. Lincoln is two lanes, but I had somebody to the left of me. I had somebody behind me. There was just, and I had somebody in front of me. By the time I saw this pothole, it was too late. And if I swerved, I would have sideswiped the guy beside me. If I hit the brakes, I got somebody in my back seat. So I just hit that fucker square. And immediately the tire goes, blah, 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 blah. And there's no shoulder. There's no, and this is a pretty busy thoroughfare. So I bring it up just as far as where Ridge Avenue exits. So this two lane very briefly becomes like a three lane where the exit takes place. And I figure that's about as good as I can get. So I pull over, get the kid out of the car, because I'm like, you know, people are coming around the bend. Half of them are on their phones looking up just in time to swerve out of the way of hitting my car.
Oh, God.
Wait for AAA for an hour for that. And I'm telling them, listen, you laid me out here for much longer and I'm going to get hit. You know, there's just, it's not if, it's when one of these guys are going to come around the corner and smack me. And I'm waiting out there for an hour. My wife comes around, picks up Max and drops off a charging cord because I've got an iPhone 6. And as soon as I step outside of the car, it had been charging inside the car. As soon as I step outside of the car and it gets that temperature change, I go from 50% to 3%. Like,
no,
in a minute.
Because
I'm a dummy and I still got the iPhone 6. I didn't, you know, I haven't gotten a chance to get the battery updated yet. And I'm telling you, just as a side, having been an Apple user since 1991 exclusively, I'm looking at that Samsung Galaxy really, really closely right now because I'm so pissed off at the eye. So this was my Sunday. Oh, and did I mention it's my in-law's car? It's not my car. It's my in-law's car that I choose to do all this with. So along with everything else, see, they moved to Philadelphia a long time ago to kind of be close to the grandkids, and they just parked their car on our street, and we've got a set of keys, and it's the standing rule is if you need two cars on a certain day, just take our car, and our car is your car that day.
And that's great.
That's wonderful, right, until some douchebag son-in-law takes a pothole and just ruptures the hell out of the tire. So,
well, should we make a new family rule that the douchebag son-in-law is not allowed to borrow the car with this? Maybe that's the way to handle this.
I'll tell you, I would not argue a bit if they decided that was the way they wanted to handle it. I couldn't even argue with them.
I have a couple big takeaways from the story. The first is I am shocked, as I'm sure every listener out there is, that the well-run municipality that is the city of Philadelphia didn't fill this pothole, because Philadelphia is famous for being a well-run city with no problems.
Max and I heard on the drive to school the next day on the news, they were saying, oh, and be careful on Lincoln Drive coming in towards the city. There's going to be road crews
fixing that specific pothole.
Starting exactly at the exit that I was at and working.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So the second takeaway I have from this story is, you know, when you don't know a city really well and someone else is explaining a story. So I want to give you a snippet into my brain as you were explaining this story.
Yeah.
OK, right. Here's what it sounded like to me. So I'm going down 222 and I just passed Lincoln Ford exit and I passed Joe's famous pastrami shop. You know this one. You know what I'm talking about. Right where the big pine tree is. Anyway, so I exit there on Turnbuckle Street. And old lady Hibbins is out on her porch, and I wave to her right as I hit this pothole. But you know old lady Hibbins, she's got no phone. So So she can't call anybody. And then Bippy, her son, you know Bippy. He's the one with the weird tooth. Yeah. You know, this is what, that's what that story sounded like to me. You're like, so I'm going down this famous serpentine street called Bippity Boppity. I'm like, I have no idea what any of this is. This is great.
Well, listen, anybody from Philadelphia will know exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, it speaks to your storytelling abilities that I was enthralled not knowing any of those street names. That was great.
Well, the coda was we had planned dinner with my in-laws days ago for that night. So it was like, you know, you really can't get out of it. You know, you're kind of... And besides, where was I going to drive to? So
yeah, exactly. So I got to ask you, did you break the tire or the wheel?
I dented the rim.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy, you did hit a pothole.
Yeah.
So oh, man.
So it wasn't just the tire. I'm replacing the entire wheel.
Oh, sensor, that's a
the
rim, bummer.
The whole nine yards. Yeah.
And you might have alignment issues now. Listen to us. Suddenly we've become click and clack on Car Talk.
I took it to a shop. Well, you know Lynette's Golf Station over there on Spring Garden.
Oh, my God. That's the best capstone to that. You know Lynette. He's the one that's got the weird ear, the one that goes too high on his head. Anyway, I'm down at his shop.
No, I you know how you always got that guy that you trust. And, you know, these folks over there, I really do. And so I took it over there and I said, just, you know, let me know what the damage is. I come to dinner that night. My father-in-law meets me at the door with a bottle of red wine with a straw in it, hands it to me and says, I figured you need this.
That's delightful.
And I'm like, you know what? I would almost be happier if you guys would just yell at me for a little bit. If you just call me an asshole for like 5 minutes, that I know I could get my head around, you know. But being nice, I I would rather you were mad at me.
Well, let me ask you this, because I understand that attitude. But do you think that's partially that you're, as a grown man, do you in those situations a little bit revert to being a kid and just wanting it over with? Like, just give me the help that I got to take for
just
this.
Just ground me.
Yeah, just ground me. And then I know, because I know, it's not like you were at fault, but there's a part of you that's forever the 18-year-old, like, oh, I messed up dad's car.
Exactly. And he called up the next day. He says, well, listen, tell me what that is and I'll split it with you. And I'm like, no.
He says,
well, it is my car. And I'm like, yeah, but your car was doing just fine until your son-in-law got behind the wheel.
Listen, your daughter made a terrible mistake, so you need to
tell you something. You do not need to cover this for almost 20 years now. Oh man, but yeah, that was my Sunday. It could not have been. Oh, and so I'm standing there by the side of the road, right? And do you want to know in a time where you don't want to be recognized? I'm sitting by the side of the road. All of a sudden, I get a message on my phone. One of Max's friends from school, their family drove by, and they're like, "Oh, I saw you by the side of the road. If you need anything, just give me a holler." And I'm like, "Gee, that's really nice, but the last thing I want to do is have anybody see me here standing by the side of the road." And I'm there. And like I said, I was there for an entire hour standing out there. One guy pulled up, an African-American man who couldn't have been more than 30, pulls up and he goes, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine. Are you okay? This is dangerous." You're really nice, but you should not be pulled over right now. I shouldn't be pulled over. We should all be doing something else. But you know, I thanked him profusely and I'm like, "I appreciate it. You know, everybody's okay. You know, AAA's on the way. We're good. Get out of here before somebody sideswipes you," you know? And then we found out that two other friends from Max's school had driven by that day and then asked Max why we were sitting by the side of the road. And I'm like, you know, out of all the times that you'd really, really want to be completely anonymous in a big city, the one thing I figured I could count on Philadelphia for was anonymity, right? I had three different families all knowing what I was doing that day.
Plus, oh my God!
Plus a stranger. So four families total.
But it turns out Mrs. Tibbins drove by. Mrs. Palkowski, who lives over on Susquehanna Street,
Palkowski, she drove by. Can't keep her mouth shut.
I just love how this became such an East Coast story. Old Mr. Lynette that runs Lynette's Tire Shop, he drove by. You know, he's the one on 23rd and 4th. Anyway.
Oh man, I'm telling you, that was a
Well, so the final fallout of this is that the car is being fixed as we speak.
The car is fixed. It was, to be honest with you, Dave, a fraction of what I was thinking I was going to pay for it, to be honest with you, because I figured I'd bent the axle and everything else, you know. So it was about a fraction of what I was expecting to pay. And actually, as soon as we get done here, I'm going to go pick it up and everything will be A-OK once again until I get behind the wheel again.
So if you're in Philadelphia, just a heads up, keep an eye out for
Brad. That's right. That's right.
And you're going to want to take a side street if you see him. And on that note, hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a fool of yourself from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, his friend who'll never get into a car with him, and cartoonist of Drive, and Sheldon, and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab.
And I'm going to say that again, because patreon.com/comiclab, because we are so close to being able to hire a permanent editor. We need 8 more patrons. And frankly, here's what you need to know. We have been recording a patron-only podcast all along called Pro Tips that have been going up on the site. And we now have 5.5 hours, Brad, of additional podcasting that is only for patrons up on patreon.com/comiclab.
That's pretty impressive. When you had written that out, you sent me the email last night, I'm like, there's no way that can be true. And right? I went back and checked, and it's like, yeah, those shows really add up.
Yeah, 20 minutes here, 25 minutes there, 15 minutes there, that all adds up. So yeah. Now is a great time. If you're enjoying the show, if you enjoy listening while you draw or listening while you drive, there's another 5.5 hours of shows that you have never heard because you are not yet a patron. So jump on over to patreon.com/comiclab and help us get a permanent editor.
Let me say one thing about that, those private shows, and that is this. Some people are like, well, I'm not so sure how that's going to work. Do I have to download the podcast through Patreon? No, you get actually a private RSS feed that goes into your podcast player on your smartphone, just the way any other podcast goes in. The only thing is you put it in manually through this private RSS feed. But once you've got that, which is like a 3-step process, once you've got that, that thing just pops up every time that we upload it. So you don't have to go through a special site to get it. It's as easy as any other podcast that you listen to.
Well, speaking of podcasting, because I want to share this with you and with everybody at home. You know, I'm podcasting from my closet now. We've sort of soundproofed it and getting it working. It's a little tricky, but we're getting it working.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was drawing Drive the other day. And so I said to my assistant, Beth, as she was finishing up a task, hey, could you check different audio levels in the closet with one moving blanket, two moving blanket, no moving blankets, and see which sounds the best, right?
Yeah.
And this is what I hear in the audio check later on when I'm listening to the differences. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right.
All right. This is sound test with no blankets. Soft talking, normal talking, la la la. And louder talking. This is Dave laughing. Ha ha. Ha ha.
So I want you to know the level of respect that I engender around the office.
Clearly.
That apparently that's what I sound like when I laugh. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, you can almost hear the reverence in her voice.
Yeah, it's a real quality working relationship we have here at the studios here. So anyway, I thought you would appreciate
yes.
that. I'm listening back on the audio files going, hey, wait a minute, I have feelings.
Well, and is the Wi-Fi fixed in that closet now too?
Well, actually, I wanted to tell you about this because as a non-paid plug, we ended up getting this thing at Costco called the Orbi system. I don't know if you've heard about this.
No.
I had not. My brother recommended it to me. Orbi is a mesh Wi-Fi network, which is, I guess, the sort of next-gen version of Wi-Fi. And what it does is it creates 3 different bands on one network.
Ooh.
So you have a 5 gigahertz, a 2.4 gigahertz, and a second 5 gigahertz. But you only have one login. So your Wi-Fi across the house, all your different devices, of which there are a proliferating number of devices across a house, they can all choose a band that works for them, 2.4, 5, another 5. And then you just log into one Wi-Fi and it finds the devices that are on the different bands around the house. So it's an amazing system. So in a non-paid, non-pluggy kind of way, I cannot endorse Orbi enough. It's been great so far.
Nice. And everything's been working. So that was like one of the big things you had to check off your list in the new house.
Yeah, well, you know, when you move, there's like 10 things that don't work, and you're like, yeah. I just got to get this, get it working, get it working.
Yeah, and then you've got a whole list prioritized, you know, make sure we got the heat, make sure we got the water. And then Wi-Fi has got to be number three right after that.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Wi-Fi is fairly important when you're working online. So anyway, for those people that are setting up a shared studio or have a house that has a lot of devices on an Orbi system, pretty good. Over at Costco, probably at Sam's Club or whatever else. Can't recommend it enough. And then, Brad, I should remind everybody that we have a Drunk Comic Lab coming up.
Yes.
We'll probably record it this weekend. You and I have had different situations where we couldn't do it. But we're already at 120, which is 80 more people on to 200. So I want to propose, without even talking to Brad,
yeah,
that we will do a Drunk Comic Lab every time we get to an additional 100. What do you think?
I like that idea. I just like the idea of drinking and podcasting. So if you have to have a reason, like another 100 five stars, that's fine. But I'm just up for opening the bottle.
In the meantime, it's 10 a.m. Brad's got the straw and the wine again. And,
yeah, believe me, I took him up on that.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so that I think that's all the housekeeping we have for this week.
Yeah. Other than the fact that for our patrons, go take a look at the Comic Lab site on Patreon. Dave has posted photos of his new studio and all the original art on the walls and stuff like that. So that's been, I could see from the amount of likes on that, people are really enjoying that. So if you want to see Dave's new digs, although one person did say, Dave, he wants to see that closet. So we got to make sure we get a lens inside there so we can see what you look like when you're doing Comic Lab.
Yeah, how exciting to see a man squatting over a box with some styrofoam in it. And I should mention this, though. It got so dang hot in here last week during the podcasting, and my laptop got really warm.
Yeah.
So what I've done is I've put a bowl of ice underneath my laptop.
Did you really?
That way, and so far it's keeping the room cool, I got to say.
Yeah.
So as a workaround, because you don't want to bring a fan in here because you don't want to add noise to a soundless room.
Right. Yeah, that's the catch 22 that you're under. You know, you can't put in like an AC vent or something in there because it's going to ruin it.
So other than podcasting naked, the only other thing I could think of was to have a big bowl of ice in here.
And well, that's, you know, next week you can sprinkle in some rose petals and kind of like put a little potpourri in there, and you'll have the cool air, and it'll be scented, and you can do all kinds of things with that.
It'll just be Calgon, take me away in here.
I'll be midway through another one of my long, boring stories, and I'll just hear Dave going.
I'm running out of oatmeal for my tub soak.
I've gotten a little bit self-conscious about stories because I recorded a podcast as a guest for somebody else, another person that I had met at that Patreon conference. He had me on his podcast. And I swear to goodness, I was in the middle of a story three different times, and he interrupted me and changed the subject. And I'm like, really? Do you know who you're talking to? I tell stories. This is what I do. You know, some of them even have a point if you give me long enough to do it. But yeah, he did three different times. I was like right in the middle of telling a story about how I got from point A to point B in my career, and he just like it jumped in, interrupted, and redirected.
Well, now I know where I stand with this guy.
Yeah, so I've been a little bit self-conscious. So if I start going on long, Dave, you just jump right in and redirect.
No. But your point actually raised the thing I forgot to talk with you about last week, which is, speaking of critiquing stories, did you see the Eisner list for this year come out?
I did. And I see that I wasn't on it again.
I like that your immediate response was, bleh. Yeah, they unfairly left us off again, Brad. I don't know. It must be a clerical error. I'm sure that will be repaired.
I got Jackie Estrada on speed dial, and I usually call her around May every year. And I'm saying, I text her at this point. I just say, are you sure? And she says, yeah, I'm sure. I said, okay, see you next year.
All right, Jackie. Well, look out for my submission about 340 days from now. Huh?
Yeah. See you next year.
Well, anyway, so here's my conundrum. Okay, so I am not, listen, as the older I get, especially, I recognize that I am not the most tapped in person in the world. Like, you know, I've got some old man tendencies of like, what's going on? Yeah. But I have to say this about the Eisners, though. The last couple of years, I will look on that list and I'm not being hyperbolic when I say 70 to 90% of those titles I've never heard of before. And my question to you is, has comics gotten so big that even people who are fairly well into comics, like you and I, don't know everything? Or is there something, or am I just an idiot? That's option number two. Am I just a moron?
As much as I'd love to pursue that option, unfortunately, I can't. Actually, you know what? This is the first time that somebody has said, you know, maybe part of the thing is comics has gotten so big that, you know, we don't have our thumb on it. It's not us and it two dozen other people. It's bigger than that. That's something I actually hadn't considered, and it makes me feel a lot better. But no, I feel more and more out of touch especially when the Eisners come out, because it's like, I'm like you. I haven't heard of any of these people. I'm looking at the list right now, and I don't think I don't want to name them by name, but none of them I notice. And one of them is something from a weather.com feature.
Wait, weather.com, like the weather site?
The weather site, yeah. It was about climate change but they used a graphic novel kind of technique to talk about weather change. But by the way, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be considered because of that, but it wasn't a webcomic like you and I might do, where you update it every week or you update it on a regular basis. It was like, from what I can tell, a one-time project.
But how, I mean, I guess we should be thankful, I guess, that American audiences have grown more Japanese, that even weather.com will run a graphic novel.
Yes.
or a comic. So that's good. So I don't begrudge them that. But yeah, my sense is that there are so many comics in so many places and in so many versions and outlets that there's no way for one of us to keep up. And maybe really the only good survey of comics every year is the five people that literally see everything in comics by judging the Eisner. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, I'll give you a counterexample. Whenever the Ignatz Awards comes out, that's the one at SPX, mm-hmm. right? The mm-hmm. Small Press Expo. So those are all the, how would you describe them? The stapled comics, right? What are those called? The mini comics.
Yeah, they're very independent, like hardcore right. independent comics.
Right. So whenever those come out, I'm always like, well, okay, I don't feel so bad not knowing any of these titles, because those are a lot of the hand pass comics that are, you know, they're physically printed and stapled and sold at, you know, $2 to $5 at comic shows and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And local comic shops. So I don't feel bad about not knowing those. But the Eisners, which are ostensibly the Oscars of comics, when those come out and I don't know all five titles that in a whole category, I'm like, boy, I'm a dummy. I'm a big dummy.
Yeah.
I don't know any of this. So I don't know how to process that.
Well, there's something else too that I really, this year more than ever, really kind of sprang on me. And that is that, you know, we've always kind of called the Eisner the Oscars of the comics industry. And this
right.
year, that really is, even in a different aspect, true. Because in the same way the Oscars never really promote comedy and humor, right? If you might have done the best comedy of the year, you're always going to lose to a drama. You're never going to get the Oscar for that. And I'm like, for example, best webcomic, Awaiting a Wave is about climate change. Not a lot of laughs there. you know, a perfectly great comic and one that we need. I'm not downplaying
it. You said that.
But
that was the greatest cameo. Not a lot of laughs there. In the impending doom of our grandkids. Yeah, a lot of laughs.
Here's another one. Dispatch from a Sanctuary City. I don't think that's going to have a lot of bright moments, right?
God. Yeah, all right.
So coming from somebody that does humor, here's the other one. Welcome to the New World. Guess what that's about? Syrian refugees. Wonderful. Great topic. And I think it needs to be taught. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't have, but there's no humor in here, right? It is not
right.
something that is going to be.
So you're saying that the Eisners are walking the path that the Oscars are, which is it's only important if it's serious, right? Is that what
it's
you're
gotta
saying?
It's got to have gravitas.
Right. It's got to change the world. I see what you're saying.
And there's an awful lot of great comics that don't have gravitas, don't have an ounce of gravitas in a single year.
Right. But,
but they're still great comics.
Yeah. The counterpoint, of course, being that is that the humor of those probably saved more than a few people in a moment of dark depression that could have gotten real, real dark. You know what I mean?
Well, you got depressed reading about Syrian refugees.
I guess you're right.
You know, after you read that comic, you got to have some Sheldon in your life.
You get to the end of the Syrian refugee comic, you're like, oh, thank God, they made it out of Syria. And then you click over to weather.com, and then, then there's a surprise waiting for you. Well, their grandkids are going to be facing some problems with rising sea levels. So,
yeah, they made it out of Syria. Now they better tread water. Oh, oh, my gosh. And the other thing is that they fall into what I would consider like one or two basic art styles. There's one that's just gorgeous, the Tea Dragon Society. Absolutely gorgeous. But a bunch of these are monochromatic, right? They've got black and white and one color to different gradients. So they're monochromatic, and they also have a very similar approach to illustration throughout a bunch of these that I'm looking at. And that's another kind of gravitas issue. You know, they've got that predetermined look that, okay, this is a serious comic, you know.
Right, kind of like when you know a New Yorker by the look of it. I know what you mean, that you know, yes, these are serious comics by the look of them. Yeah, I get what you're saying. The one that I did notice, just to put a little hat on this conversation, is that I did notice Monstrous, which I thought was beautifully drawn and an mm-hmm. interesting story. So I was happy to see that one on there that I knew. And I'm sure that if you polled our listeners, there's probably another dozen on there that they themselves read. I don't know what to make of that when I... I made a documentary about comics, and I didn't know 80% of these.
Yeah, well, that makes me feel better because I figure you're more tuned in than I am. Yeah. But
I mean, I have two master's degrees in the history of comics, and I didn't know 80% of these. So I'm not saying this to be egotistical. I'm just saying I didn't know any of this. And so, like, basically what I'm asking is how are we meant to process this? I guess the positive outlook is, hey, here's a bunch of new comics to check out that you weren't aware of, but maybe are worthy of praise and a second look or a first look. So I guess that's the optimistic way to look at it. The pessimistic way to look at it is, Brad, you and I are never being nominated for an Eisner. That's the pessimistic way.
No, and you know what? I've kind of gotten over that a long time ago. I very much in the middle of my career where it stands now, like 2010 through 2015 or so, this would always be a tough time of year for me because I really, in my mind, thought that I was doing work that was nomination ready, you know, or it was nominatable. Now, looking back, not so much. Yeah. You know? Yeah. I'm like, nah, you weren't ready yet. They made the right choice right there. But yeah. But in my mind, it was always a blow to my ego that I was not getting nominated. And the one time I did get nominated for an Oscar, or got nominated for an Eisner, I convinced myself mentally that they had made a mistake, that because Fables was very similar to the Fables that was very popular being published in comics, Fables. So okay. I've always kind of convinced myself that that was more of a clerical error than anything else.
Your Fables was really unique and interesting. And I thought I was very happy when you got nominated for an Eisner for that one.
I was too.
But I will tell you this, though, as a friend, since you said it, looking back on it, the times that I got nominated for an Eisner, I don't know that I deserved it looking back on it. Like, I mean, they were perfectly lovely books. They were good. But so I think I agree with you. But having said that, every year for about an hour after I read the Eisner list, if you talk to me during that hour, I'm like, I will just admit to a human moment that every year I'm like, well, fine, if that's the way they want to do it. You know?
I hope they choke on those little globes.
I don't want an Eisner anyway. Yeah. But it only lasts about, I have to say, it lasts less and less the older I get. In my 20s and 30s, it would hurt so bad when I didn't get nominated because I just thought, like, I just wanted it so bad. And now I think the hallmark for me of success is, hey, it's another year of me being a cartoonist. Like, that's enough.
That's exactly like, right. That's where I've come to. It's like my award is the fact that I had a great year last year. I paid the bills, paid my taxes. Everybody's happy and healthy. And I did it in such a way that this is what I wanted to do since I was 12 years old. I was a professional cartoonist for another year and did some work that I'm really proud of. And that's my reward. And I don't know how many people are able to really say that. And I count among those award winners and non-award winners alike. Can they really say that they were doing that? Some of them yes, some of them no. And right. would I want to change places with any one of them? Nah, I'll take what I've got any day of the week. I got it.
Yeah.
My award is, hey, you got to live this life. That's an award in itself. I don't need, I've gotten to the point where I really don't need anything else.
Yeah, like I have to say, that's a great way to put it. Would I change places with any of the titles on there? And
no.
I don't think I would. I love the life that I've built for myself. So
yeah.
Yeah, so that's the counterpoint to the hour after reading the Eisner list every year where I go, is that 2 hours later I go, you know what? Everything's fine. You built the comics career.
Yeah.
You're
doing it.
There's 250 professional cartoonists in America, and you're one of them, or 300, you know, however many there are.
Right.
So, so relax there, Mr. Egotistical. You don't need a little golden, tiny little soccer award on your desk to tell you you're doing okay.
No. And I'll tell you the other thing that really helped is when I made the shift to doing a series of not safe for work comics. I will die on this hill. That's some of my best work ever. It is from a craftsmanship perspective, it's really good. It's never going to win awards. You know, I can send that book off to the Eisners and the Ignatz and everybody else. Nobody's going to give that book an award, but that's some of the best work I've ever done. And once you, and for me, just for me, I went into this year with a completely different aspect in my brain because it's like, what, you think they're going to give that book an award? It's great work. You did a great Kickstarter. It's doing fine. But I'm in a place now where I don't even, I'm realistically, it's not even realistic for me to get an award for the stuff I'm doing.
Right. And for the benefit of the folks at home, I would now like to take you inside the Eisner judging room. Robert, did you read the Syrian refugee book? Oh, Susan, yes, we have to put that on the list. That's delightful. What an important mark to make on the world. And let's see, here's a submission from Brad Geiger.
Their portfolio pops off of their face.
Like the bow tie is spinning around. The adjunct professor of comics from Stanford, who's one of the judges of the Eisner. Well, let's see what this submission from Brad Geiger is. The bow tie is spinning. Steam is coming out of his ear. Well, we'll just put this over here in the special pile.
We'll put this on the pile for me to take home later tonight when nobody's looking. And I did, by the way, Dave, I did send that book into the Eisners.
As you should.
Yeah, you bet your boots I did. Because I always figure, you know, the only way to find out is to ask. And if I didn't send that book in, it was 100% no. But I did put a little note out there saying, okay, before you open this book, you better know what you're getting into.
To put a capper on the capper on the capper of this conversation, when I submitted for the Eisners, I, for Drive specifically, was the one that I was, I kind of hope this could get an award. That'd be neat. And so I submitted it to webcomic, right? That's a natural one.
Yeah.
I submitted it to graphic novel because they had the 300-page hardcover came out last year. So I submitted for that one. I submitted for, like, there was five or six different categories where, honestly, I was looking at it going, because they don't provide descriptions of the categories. And I was going, I mean, I guess it does fall under that category.
Yeah.
I guess it doesn't fall under this category. So I a little bit wonder if judges look at it and go, look, this guy doesn't even know what he's submitting for. He put 10 categories down for this thing. Like, but like... Am I a good cartoonist? I mean, I guess Drive could be for that. Is it a graphic novel? Yeah, I guess it could be for that. Is it a webcomic? It also is a webcomic. Like, so I wonder if I should just pick one next year and just stick with that. I don't know.
Nah, I would encourage you to do exactly what you did. Put it in for as many different categories as you can, because, you know,
yeah.
Just increase your chances, in my opinion. Did you put Drive
like
in for a Hugo?
A Hugo. I did, but I don't know that I have any impact in that world at all.
Really? Because I think that's a tailor-made for Hugo.
Well, it's not in any of the publishing world, and I think a lot of the science... Honestly, Brad, I don't know. I went to the Hugos once as an award weekend. Dave Malky and I went, and boy, if you think the Comic-Cons are exclusionary as a show, you should go to the Hugos at one point. Brad, I got to tell you, if you like hanging out with 70-year-old white guys, the Hugos are the show. For you, Brad, I've got a show for you. It's the Hugos. If you like talking about your geriatric surgeon and being white, then that's the convention you want to attend. If you've got nurse's shoes on and you're an old white guy, than the Hugos. By the way, guess who just effed his chances of ever being nominated for a Hugo Award?
Yeah, keep going. We'll see if we can't get you on a special list at the Hugos. Never, ever, ever list.
Mortimer and Gerald are gonna knock me off of the Hugo invite list, I guess. No, I don't know what the nature of it is as an institutional thing, but it just, you notice it when you walk in. I was like, wow, this is a very old show and it's very white. And I was like, this is interesting. And listen, I was very happy to see a lot of people from all across the spectrum that were there. But you know what? When you notice a crowd, when you notice an aspect to a crowd and you're like, no, this is a lot of dudes and it's a lot of 70-year-old dudes and a lot of 70-year-old white dudes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that that's the case. Like, I see why, being someone who's kind of outside that world, I see why the Hugos had those problems with their awards a few years ago. Anyway, that having been the year that I chose to go, I was like,
that's the year you were there?
I see why this community had this problem, yeah. Because you're like, this is not a very inclusive group. But anyway, so for all you 70-year-old white listeners out there, I encourage you to jump in on the Hugos.
Boy, do we have good news for you.
Boy, there is a spot for you still in America, and it's not Denny's. All right, so Brad, let's turn to one of the $5 questions.
Here's one that I'd like to hear about from you, honestly, because, well, I'll get to that in a minute. What are your favorite and most effective ways of warming up before sitting down to draw? Do you practice drawing different characters, poses, expressions, etc.?
So I will answer super honestly to this, and you can tell me that I'm an idiot right away. I don't warm up sketch.
Neither do I, and that's exactly what I want to talk about. I think everybody's lying about warming up. I listen, do you ever see on Twitter and Facebook and some of these places, somebody post up their warm-up sketch and it looks better than something you spent 10 hours on?
Yes, exactly.
I think people are lying through their teeth about warming up. Now,
hold on. That's a whole different topic. People lying about what they're, here's a 5-minute sketch that I did and there's perfectly rendered colors and shading and you're like, bullshit, that's not a 5-minute sketch.
You're full of shit if that's a warm-up.
Yeah. Unless you're a DreamWorks animator and you crank out animation all day long, you're not sketching that fast. But yeah, so that's a different topic. But no, the idea for me that, I mean, Brad, I've been drawing Sheldon since 1998 online, but I first started drawing it as a comic strip in 93 in my college paper. Right. So that's 25 years of drawing that character. If I don't know how to draw that duck by now, what warm up sketch is going to help me draw that duck? You know what I mean? Like what changes another 5 minutes of sketching? So frankly, I'm too pressed for time. Like when I have
thank you.
As we talk about week to week, I don't have time to warm up. So granted, now we're going to get a serious artist on the show and go, well, Dave, there's a reason why your art is stuck in first gear, and that's because you don't do warm-up sketches. I'm sure that any instructor out there would immediately go,
well,
when I say that I don't do warm-up.
Have one of those guys on the show because I don't want to hear it. I don't know about you.
I mean, so for example, when I'm drawing digitally with Drive, my warm-up sketch is if I draw the first figure and it looks like crap, then I just erase it and redo it. Like that's my warm-up sketch.
No, my pencils are kind of like my warm-up. You know, when I do my sketches for I don't know, talking crafts with you, I always do it. I work in Manga Studio or Clip Studio Paint now. And I always do my pencil in different colors, like blue and purple and red, and I'll layer on top of layer, like I'll get a body right and the head wrong. Well, then I'll do the head in a different color. And then I've got maybe 20 different layers, all different colors when I do my final sketches of things that, okay, or if I've got two people, I'll do one in one color and the other in another color, because then inevitably I've got to change the proportions on the one to match the other. And that's easier if they're on different layers. Do you do the same thing?
Well, no, this is interesting to hear you say this. So you do multiple layers of different colors and the colors and the layers help you differentiate. I get that.
Yeah.
So what I do is I have in my sketching, I'll have, if I'm working digitally, I'll have multiple layers, but they're all set to different transparencies. So the first pass sketch will be at 10%. The next pass sketch will be at 30%, and then the finalized sketch will be like at 60%. Like that's and usually, frankly, I will get roughly what I want out of the first sketch. It usually doesn't take me. I mean, usually head positioning, I'll maybe futz with that, like you said.
Yeah.
But usually what I've been trying to do more and more is I have I'd had the pleasure of holding on to some of Watterson's originals. And when he sent me the original that he did for Strip, for the poster, he mailed it just normal. And I was like, Bill, what are you doing? Why? This should be in like a lead box held
don't
by.
Don't you know who you are?
Four armed guards, and it's just coming through US mail. One little piece of cardboard behind it. I was like, what are you doing, Bill? So I opened it up and I'm looking at very closely at his original art. And I realized that his life of his drawing comes in the inking. So he just does very basic pencil wireframing, or not even wireframing, just basic like a line to indicate the top of a head, another line to indicate the location, but just a line to indicate the depth and location of the hand, right? You know, different things that you would need just to bare bones roadmap of how to put ink down. And then he lets the inking stage be the life of it. And I think that's kind of a version of what we were talking about a few weeks back, which is when I was encouraging people to have imperfections because it has a livelier line. Mm-hmm. And Watterson, I think, does that too, is that he just puts bare bone pencil down so that the ink has a livelier, sketchier feel where he's discovering it as he's drawing. And so I've been trying more and more. This became a long story. I've been trying more and more with Drive to just do wireframe or basic like volume indicators to say, here's how tall this alien will be. Here's how wide this alien will be. I need to scooch him over to make space for this other person. And so that way the fun of it comes out in the inking rather than overly wrought 17 pencils underneath an ink sketch, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
But that being said, I make just as many mistakes there too, and then it's control alt delete, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep, so yep. And then re-inking.
Yeah, re-inking. But the idea being that if I do happen upon the magic of a lively sketch, quote unquote, it's done in ink. And so then if I did it right, then I can keep it. You know, like it's always the worst when you capture the perfect magic in pencil and you're like, well, shit, it was in pencil. Now I got to redo it.
Now what do I do?
Yeah, now I got to recapture that magic moment. So basically what I'm trying to do is if I do it in inks, then it's ready to go and I'll just delete it if it wasn't magical, you know, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, like you, I use a bunch of layers, and for me, it's transparencies, and for you, it's colors. That's an interesting way to go.
I'm happy to hear. It's been one of those things that I've been always scared to talk about in public, because all these people around me seem to be doing warm-ups, and some of them do warm downs, which I never understood either.
Warm downs?
Warm downs.
This is a warm down.
Yeah, I've seen that on social media.
Richard, my hand is so tired from drawing, I've got to do a warm down. Oh, Eustace, I couldn't agree more. Would you pass me another martini while I finish my warm down?
Listen, fixing a martini, that is a warm down. stir, you're warm down.
Well, not to sound huffy, but like my warm down is the 20 other things that I have to get done in my to-do list that day. That's my warm down.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Yeah,
Warm down. I just feel like, oh my goodness, that round of golf was so tiring. I need to do just some putting for 10 minutes just to cool down from that long day on the back nine.
And what's going to happen if you don't warm down? Is your hand just going to kind of snap into position? I don't understand that.
It's a form of rigor mortis claw that your hand goes into. Like, oh God, Bradley, I didn't do my warm down, and now I've got rigor mortis hand.
Well, I think we pretty much slaughtered that one. So let's move on to this next one.
Hold on. We didn't really answer that, though. Let's say hypothetically you did want to do a warm-up sketch, Brad. What would you do?
Well, listen, practicing sketching is a wonderful thing. And for me, when I find myself practicing, I'm working on expressions. I'm working on drawing faces, sometimes hands and gestures. But mainly I'm trying to get a better range of expressions, because that's really, for me, how great comics get across. That's how, if you write a punchline and it's a good punchline, but you know in your heart it's not a great punchline. And we've all been there. The way you put it over the top is with a excellent expression or with a dead-on gesture, because that sells the joke, right? Right. And you can make a good piece of humor great by getting the expression dead on, by really selling it. So that's what I try to do. I try to challenge myself to draw different expressions that might be a little bit hard to get across, and different angles, you know, upper angles and lower angles and stuff like that. But that's when I'm just with my sketchbook kind of passing the time, that's what I do. How about you?
Well, so again, this is going to come across as not what this person is looking for. But the way that I stretch is over the years and over the decades of cartooning, I will need to draw something like, oh, I need to draw for this joke to work. I need to draw a very specific 1950s looking rocket, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when in my career have I ever drawn that? Well, by virtue of the fact that I need it for the comic, that's how I stretch and grow, is that eventually you need to draw something that you've never drawn before. And
right.
And so for me, that's my, I guess what I'm saying is necessity is my warm-up sketch. Like if there's a Sheldon where I need to do a joke about Klingon warbird, well, guess what? I got to figure out how to draw a Klingon warbird. And then if there's a Drive where I need to draw a Spanish castle that has futuristic modifications on it, well, guess what? I got to figure out how to draw that, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, necessity of doing, of regularly producing comics is the warm-up sketch, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
To me, perfect is the enemy of good, is that phrase, you know? And warm-up sketches to me is like that there is a perfect iteration of the drawing that you're about to do, whereas I have learned over my career that good enough is good enough. And that, like, if I were to spend 3 hours doing a warm-up sketch and then a cool-down sketch and then a mid-sketch stretch where I just kind of put on my golfing slacks and take a little moment for me.
You love that voice, don't you?
I'm sorry. I'm going to listen back to this thing like, all right, asshole, we get it. Anyway, like, if I take too much time to get it just perfect, well, then I'm not getting done the I know this is keeps coming back to time.
Yeah.
But there are different ways to structure career, and there are people for whom they are going to get the right sketch if it takes 20 different drawings. Richard Thompson, one of my favorite people ever, God rest his soul, would do 40 different studies of one drawing before he would send it off to a publisher.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely a way to make a career. He produced art that was amazing, and everybody, I can't recommend enough the Art of Richard Thompson book. If you've never picked it up, it's probably discounted now. You will see an amazing craftsperson in Richard Thompson. But anyway, that's one way to structure a career. My way of structuring a career was, let's get it done, let's get it out, let's get on to the next thing. And so
yeah.
It's just a different philosophy. I never had a propensity for warm-up sketches because for me, that was preparing for a perfect drawing that was never going to come in that next hour. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. You had to do other things, especially starting out. When we started out, it was very important to be doing this on a daily basis. As we've talked in the past, that's evolved a little bit. But you couldn't get too precious with your drawings because you were going to miss tomorrow's deadline.
Yeah, and a harsher way of saying that, if we got too precious on that drawing, maybe we didn't make the mortgage that month. You know,
yeah.
Like you gotta. It's a interesting balancing act of producing, but also producing enough to pay the bills. And so
yes.
So that's Brad and my cranky version of warm-up sketches.
Well, I like it. I like it. Because it affirms something that I've always been scared to talk about.
When you and I broach a topic, it always makes me happy when we end up in the same place and we didn't know that that's where we were going to end up.
Well, let's see if that happens with this question. Many professions, and this is another one from one of our $5 Patreon backers, so I wanted to make sure I got it in. Many professions tend to have restrictions on social media, and some for good reason. You mentioned now that it's more about the creator than the product. But what if the creator doesn't want their real life out in the public eye because they fear of repercussions with their job or even safety concerns? On one hand, anonymity has led to some horrible issues in the age of harassment. And by having the Twitter egg avatar or fake media accounts or names are viewed as shady or insidious, is having a pen name or the online social media presence equivalent a possibility? Without being viewed as a stereotypical basement-dwelling edgelord. Woof. What do you think?
So, I think there's a couple ways to approach this. The first thing is to tackle it from the career standpoint. So there's a really heavy emphasis at the beginning of this question about people whose career, whose day job, for lack of a better phrase, would be seriously impacted by the fact that they're doing a comic strip that may even touch on their industry or may obliquely impact their job reviews, that kind of thing. And that is a real concern. Brad and I have a friend whose career was impacted by his online published work and had to go under a pen name and actually for a year or two stopped cartooning, if you remember, Brad.
Yes.
Because he was so afraid of losing his daily income for his family. And so it is a very real concern. And there are industries and careers and professions where your online work can impact you, sometimes rightly, sometimes unfairly, for what you produce online. So for those people and for in general, for people that might want an aspect of privacy in their life or not have to deal with the worst aspects of the internet, I personally have no problem with a pen name. I think a pen name has a long and illustrious use in literature and in art. And I think it might be worthwhile to try. Now, if you're worried about people prejudging you based on your pen name, my advice is to pick a pen name like the Nancy artist that seems real, but is just a pen name. Like, I wouldn't go with a fake name that's like Mr. Jolly Pickles. You know, like don't pick a nickname where people are like, well, that's clearly a pen name. Just go with like Tim Bibbins, you know, and you're like, well, maybe there is a Tim Bibbins or, you know, Susie Magoozy. Well, that's not Susie Magoozy. That's clearly fake. But you get where I'm going with on that, Brad. So now what's your thought, Brad? What are your thoughts about a pen name?
Oh, I'm right there with you. And I'll go this far. You're overthinking it. Okay, if you're in a situation where you've got to protect your day job or protect your family or whatever, and you think that you need to use a pen name, then you use a pen name and you're not giving up any of that where we talk about it's more about the creator than the product and you brand the creator and the product. You're still doing that. It's just the creator is this pen named entity that you're building, right?
Right.
You don't have to give up any of that. And you don't have to worry about being associated with a Twitter egg avatar or any of that other stuff unless you start acting like that. And as long as you're not acting like that, you're not going to get assumed to be like that.
Right.
There's a lot of people that are using pen names, more than you even may realize. It doesn't impact the work in the slightest, other than I think at some point, if you want to make a public appearance, you're going to have to make a decision. But if you're kind of going along the lines that I've been talking about in the past couple of years, then that's even like I'm saying, I would really, really double think whether you do comic conventions and so forth until you're really sure that you can make a profit. If that's you, then you don't even have to worry about making appearances for a little while yet. So I have zero problems with a pen name. You can still do that branding that we're talking about where you brand the creator and not so much the product. You can do all of that stuff and protect your day job and your family's privacy and stuff like that. Don't overthink it. It's very simple. Make the pen name and then brand the pen name.
The interesting thing there is that you absolutely will be giving up a certain amount of public appearances. I think that's a fair assumption. But the good news is I think we are entering a world where largely you can build a wonderful career never showing your face in public ever.
Right.
Between Kickstarter and Patreon, even if you're concerned about the videos for Kickstarter, Patreon, you can structure a video that you never appear in. It's just your voice or, you know, like all that sort of thing. But there's even one. I want to talk about this one for a second, Brad, because I so rarely get to talk about it. But I studied World War II propaganda cartoons, and there was a Soviet pen name that I always found fascinating. And I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but it was Kukrinitsky. And what it was five artists that shared one pen name.
Oh, really?
And I was like, that's fascinating that you can even have shared work or combined work or tag teaming. I guess it's a version of what's that stick figure comic that appears now as a webcomic?
Cyanide and Happiness.
Kukrinitsky was similar to that, is that it's a shared platform for different cartoonists. But anyway, so as far as pen names go, I personally have no stigma for a pen name. I think it's actually a worthwhile and interesting. For me, I like the fun of not knowing, even though I kind of know who it is, the Nancy artist, the new Nancy artist that is a pen name.
Uh-huh.
For me, it adds to the fun and the mystery that they are working behind a pen name. I think it's because, and I haven't been proven right or wrong about this, I think it's because it's a team and it's a writer and an artist on that one, but I have no inside knowledge. I seem to think that I know who the artist is, and I know that they are not a writer, so it makes me feel like there is also a writer involved. But I may be wrong, who knows? But I also think, how fun. Like, it's fun not to know. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of added
exactly
to the mystery of it. I like a pen name, so I think we can put a nice little bow on that one probably, that go for it. I see no real hindrance to your career in doing a pen name. Well, Brad, do you hear that, Brad?
Oh, I do. I hear that familiar familiar music, and you know what it means. It means you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been, and it's not a pen name, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com, and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And the real world, Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission by the very talented musician Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net.
And Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
This is Dave laughing. Ha ha!